Exodus chapter 15. Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host he cast into the sea, and his chosen officers were sunk in the Red Sea. The floods covered them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty you overthrew your adversaries. You sent out your fury, it consumes them like stubble. At the blast of your nostrils the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake. I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword. My hand shall destroy them. You blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds? Doing wonders. You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. Because of the greatness of your arm, they are as still as stone. Till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased, you will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord will reign for ever and ever. For when the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. Then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and dancing. And Miriam sang to them, Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, because it was bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, What shall we drink? And he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying, If you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God, and do that which is right in his eyes, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. Following the deliverance of chapter 14 of Exodus at the Red Sea, chapter 15 contains two great hymns of praise. In some respects, the Song of the Sea or the Song of Moses could be compared to a sort of national anthem for Israel. Both of these parts of the song are preceded by a reference to God's great act of deliverance. In chapter 14, verses 27 to 29, and in chapter 15, verses 19, the first of these great songs is led by Moses, and Moses leads the people in this song of worship and praise to the Lord. And it's followed by a refrain led by Miriam the prophetess as she sings to the women. Perhaps we should see this as a sort of antiphonal singing, as they're singing back and forth to each other. And it seems to be part of the liturgy of victory more generally. In the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 18, verses 6 and 7, The women come out to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." A similar song can be found in chapter 5 of the book of Judges, as Deborah and Barak sing concerning their victory over Sisera and his men. This song, like the other elements round about, the legal elements, are part of the liturgical aspects of Israel's continuing life that are associated with the deliverance. This is not just a historical song. It's a song that they would have been singing in the future to memorialize this particular event and the significance of what God achieved through it. It connects the Red Sea crossing with future events, preparing us for the conquest of the land, the passing over of the Jordan, and finally the planting on God's holy mountain. It isn't just about leading them out, it ends on the theme of leading them in. "You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. Because of the greatness of your arm, they are as still as a stone. Till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased, you will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord will reign for ever and ever." It's looking forward not just to the time in the wilderness, but to the time when they'll be settled in the land. They'll be worshipping God on his holy mountain, on his abode. This song then deals with the whole range of the founding events of Israel, leading up to the completion of the significance of those events as they are finally established in worship in the land. We can see something of this in the building of Solomon's temple, where in the context of the building of that temple, there are a number of references back to the Exodus. The Exodus was always looking forward to the completion of the establishment of worship. And once that worship is established and instituted, then the Exodus has reached its purpose, the end for which it always existed. This is similar to songs of deliverance that we might find in the Psalms. And there's a sort of realized eschatology then. This event is definitive. It's definitive for Israel's deliverance. And everything else that comes next is already in this event by implication. Being led out of the land is already by implication connected with the event of being led in to the promised land. God is creating a new heavens and a new earth, and we should attend to the language of creation that's employed here, because it's drawing the events of redemption into the orbit of the symbols of creation. It's testimony to God, grounded in historical acts, in which his character and purpose are revealed, the character and purpose of a God who both creates and redeems. A God who demonstrates his power over his creation, but also his faithfulness to his people. A God who proves his supremacy over the false deities and his enemies. Verses 11 and 12, "Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them." But on the other hand, he is the God who comes near to his people, the God who is faithful, who will lead them in, who has demonstrated his commitment to them. God has never before rescued a people, delivered them from oppression in quite the way that we see here. The event produces a number of responses, the praise of Israel most notably. This whole song is a response to what God has done. It leads to the overcoming and humbling of his adversaries, and the trembling of other oppressors as they hear of the example of Egypt. The whole world is seeing this and marveling. This is a declaration of divine purpose and of divine identity. And as we read through this song, maybe we should notice that there is a certain departicularization that occurs. This song does reference Egypt in verse 4, for instance, but as you go further into it, it's not just about Egypt. It's about something more expansive. It's about God's power over his creation. It's about God's power over oppressors and adversaries. Beyond their historical particularity, the Egyptians also stand for the chaotic forces of the world and all that might be arrayed against God. God's victory here is of cosmic significance, and it goes out to the world in its message. The importance of song more generally should be reflected upon here. Song is not just an assent to some divine truths that we sing about, but it's a stirring of emotions, a declaration of God's glory from the heart. It's a taking up of these statements in the form of the first person, where it's not just a word that God has declared that you're agreeing to, but it's something that you are declaring from within as your commitment, your belief, and your desire, and your animating passion. This exists also for the benefit of memory and for memorialization. We memorize songs. We don't necessarily intend to, but songs stick in our heads. And so if we're singing something over a period of time, it's very hard not to memorize some of the words. And putting the great deliverance of God into song is one of the ways in which these events are memorialized, so that they will not be forgotten, so that they provide the foundation for the understanding of God's self-revelation in history. As people looked back, they could see what God had done and learn who God was through his past actions. It should be noted that as we go through the book of the Psalms, again and again we encounter the event of the Red Sea crossing as a fundamental testimony to who God is, to his faithfulness, to his power, to his strength of his arm, and his supremacy over all opponents and adversaries and oppressors. God is the great warrior. He's the great king. He fights not with human weapons, but with his very creation, with the winds, with the deep, with the sea, with the flood, with the earth that swallows up his enemies. God wields nature itself against all his adversaries. This is a song of historical deliverance, but it's also a song about God's creational power. And throughout the story of the plagues, this is what we've been seeing again and again. It's God's hypernatural power, that God is using nature itself in the most powerful way to achieve his ends. In the book of Genesis, it's God using history to achieve his ends. In the story of Joseph, this comes to the forefront. And now we see God's power over nature and of history together. God is the God who controls all the forces of the world, the forces of time, the forces of space, the forces of the things and the elements that are within the creation. From this, though, there is quite a step down. They end up in a place called Marah, and they're thirsty, and there's no fresh water to drink. Perhaps this should draw our minds back to the result of the first plague, where the water was turned to blood and it could not be drunk. And that bad water was a cause of great distress and annoyance and frustration and irritation to the Egyptians. And now Israel is facing the same problem. Can God deliver them from the plagues, from the problems that these other nations might experience? This water that can't be drunk is healed by a log or some wood being placed within the water. There are a number of references to wood in the story of the Exodus that might be worth connecting with this. Perhaps we should connect it with the theme of the rod. The rod, as this wooden object, performs all sorts of miracles and wonders. Putting the log or the wood into the water has a desalination effect. It removes the salt brackiness from the water, and the water can be drunk. Now, is this a miracle, or is it some natural power of this particular type of wood? It could quite possibly be the latter. God instructs Moses to do this thing. It's not a command, as he was commanded to stretch out his rod so that the waters would be divided in a miraculous way. Rather, maybe God is instructing Moses in how to use elements of the world itself to achieve his ends. Maybe God is equipping Moses to engage in the use of nature itself to achieve great purposes. The event here, however, shows that God's power over creation is not merely to destroy or to use it as a weapon, but it can be healed. God can restore the creation. God can make the creation a life-giving source, not just a source of death and destruction and judgment. This is the reversal of the first plague, and now Moses and the people can drink from water that was formerly undrinkable. One interesting feature of this narrative is the possibility that it may be playing upon the name of Miriam. Miriam has just been present in the story of the Red Sea crossing and the worship afterwards. That calls our mind back to the original deliverance from the water that Moses experienced as an infant, where once again Miriam was present, and she was active just afterwards. She provided nursing for the child that was delivered from the reeds. Now the people have been delivered from the sea of reeds, and she is the one who sings with Moses at that great deliverance. And following that singing, water is provided. Miriam's name seems to mean bitter sea, or maybe it means rebellion. But the same letters are found in a number of different words within this passage. The name of Mara itself, the word for bitter, the word for the waters, the word for the name of the place itself. Maybe there is some association with Miriam and the waters. Now, this might all seem very speculative, and it is speculative. But when we go further on in the story, there seems to be some hint of a connection between Miriam and the water in the wilderness. And as we look through the book of Numbers, perhaps we'll study this in more detail. Here, however, God is testing his people. He's testing if they're going to be obedient. God is giving them commandments and instructions, not just as a testing of whether they're absolutely loyal to him, but in order that he might be their healer. The purpose of God's instructions and commandments to his people is in order that they might know well-being, that they might be people who rejoice in his presence and his good gifts, not people who are just obedient because of command, but people who delight in what God gives them, who know him as their provider, as their healer, and as their guide through the wilderness. God will heal then and deliver his people. This is not just negative. A question to consider. There are 70 palm trees and 12 springs of water at Elim. Why would we be told those details? Why do those numbers have some significance?